Through this gospel series of meetings, we've shared with you the first two nights things pertaining to really alternatives to a belief in the Bible, a belief in God, and a belief in Jesus Christ. And we have looked at the various elements of theories that are out there today that would try to give some kind of ideology or philosophy, or even under the pretext of science, an alternative to believing those things. Well, what we've examined is that we don't always hear all the facts, let alone the difficulties that those particular theories face, and in sometimes some tragic failures. And when we've looked at these, what we've ultimately helped you to do is to build your faith. But to build your faith, to understand that it's okay not to believe in those things because they fail certain tests, but also to let you know and to help you appreciate that what you have put your faith in is true. And so today, this being the Lord's Day, the last two services that we have planned, the two lessons that we have planned for this gospel meeting, we plan to actually share with you things that are pertaining to the Lord. It's only appropriate today that we build Him up and give Him glory in all of the things of which we know about Him. This morning, we're going to spend some time looking at a case of whether or not Jesus is who He claimed to be. As it says here, who was Jesus? Was He holiness or was He a hoax? And the reason I ask those questions is not to belittle Jesus, because I honor Jesus and I believe Him to be the Lord and the Christ. But I ask those questions because many have those questions in the world today. Yes, though Christianity is the most popular of all religions in the world, making up nearly two-thirds of the population of this earth at 2.3 billion people who claim Christ to be who He is, but maybe not reflecting it in their lives. The point is that many people have put faith in Jesus Christ, and we need to ask the question, is it really true? Is it really true, or a lot of these people misled? Because there's other ideas, other religions, and other beliefs that are out there. And those who do believe in Jesus Christ constantly struggle with the idea of whether Jesus truly is, and can we prove Him to be, according to the claims of the Scriptures. And so, we want to answer some of those questions. And we especially want to answer those questions for those who might be skeptical, who come to us in honest heart and ask us, why do you believe in Jesus Christ? Why do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Or even, why do you believe there is a God? And I think Jesus helps to answer that question. And so this morning, we want to spend a few minutes looking at this idea to help you not only with your faith, but help you also to share that story with others who are out there, so that hopefully they may take the time to reflect upon these facts and to consider Jesus as a part of their life, and especially their eternity when this life is over, and what the ramifications will be based on their belief, whether they believe in Christ or if they don't. So first thing I want to begin with is, let's be clear. The Bible definitely states that Jesus is divinity. A lot of people think that He was at least a unique and special person in history. Some think that maybe He was at least a prophet or a man of God. But I don't want there to be any mistake. The Bible is clear that Jesus is stated to be the Son of God in many cases. In many cases. For instance, from the New Testament in 1 John chapter 4, in verse 14 and 15, I'm going to move around here so I don't block this side of the room from seeing the slides. In verses 14 and 15, it says, "We have seen and testify that the Father has sent the Son as Savior of the world. Whoever confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God abides in him and he in God." And so it's clear. It is stated there that Jesus is the Son of God according to John. In the book of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 4, in verses 14 through 16, the writer there says, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession." And so the Hebrew writer not only states that He is the Son of God, but he says, the confession of which we have, which is the precipice of our belief, we confess Jesus before men. We confess Jesus as the Son of God. We also find that Jesus taught that He was the Son of God. It isn't just the claims of individuals who wrote the Scriptures, but Jesus Himself taught this basic principle. In John chapter 12, verse 25, He says, "I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name," referring to God, "they bear witness of me." Verse 30, "I and my Father are one." Now, he doesn't just come out and say, I am the Son of God, but he necessarily infers that God, of whom he is speaking of, is his Father. And the inference there is, if he is his Father, then Jesus is his Son. We see in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 32, Jesus says, therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him will I also confess before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, him I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven. And so there's no doubt that Jesus isn't talking about a man named Joseph. He's not talking about an earthly man. He's talking about someone who's in heaven. And he is speaking of God, and he goes on, and we'll clarify this in other passages. Notice here in John chapter 9 and verse 35, Jesus heard that they had cast him out, speaking of one of whom he had healed. And when he found him, he said to him, do you believe in the Son of God? Now we get down to some very specific language. We're no longer inferring anything. He's asking about a belief in the Son of God. Notice what it goes on to say here. And he said, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? And Jesus said to him, you have both seen him, and it is he who is talking to you, or talking with you. Then he said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. He worshiped him. Why did he worship him? He worshiped him because he was the Son of God. He was divinity among men, and he recognized that. And certainly Jesus appeals to the idea that he is the Son of God, and he is making reference to that case being himself. In Mark chapter 14, verse 61, again, the high priest asked him, now in this case, it is not out of an inquiry of curiosity, but instead, Jesus is on trial, and they are about to put him to death, and if he says that he is the Son of God, it is exactly what they're looking for to make an accusation against him. And Jesus, though, unapologetically answers this question. And they're saying to him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Jesus said, I am. I am. So he does not deny it. He does not skirt the issue. He comes forthright and says, that is exactly the case. We notice in Matthew chapter 16, verse 15, Jesus said to them, speaking to his disciples, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered and said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And so again, Jesus affirms the claim that he is the Christ, the Messiah, the promised one, and that he is the Son of God. Well, what's interesting about this is that these claims aren't just found in a particular book, and these things weren't just done in some corner of the world of which no one had heard of, and that word came forth later in time, such as some would propose. But instead, the Bible is quite clear, not only being a religious text, but also giving historical accounts and the narratives of the stories of Jesus' life, that Jesus interacted with men freely, and he would acclaim not only these things among them, but they knew of him and they knew of his teachings, and that's he was publicly renowned. In John chapter 18, beginning in verse 20, Jesus himself said, I spoke openly to the world, skipping ahead, and in secret I have said nothing. Ask those who have heard me. Indeed, they know what I said. Now, this shortened paraphrase of this passage, I'm ultimately just trying to focus in on the parts that are essential to the discussion. But the point of what Jesus is ultimately saying is I was seen of the world. They bear witness of me. You can ask them anything you want if you want to verify the story. And in this particular case, he says, they know what I have said, meaning they know what I have stated, they know what I have affirmed, they know what I have taught is my doctrine. And so it was no doubt that the world understood what Jesus was proclaiming. And in Matthew chapter 4, verses 23 through 25, and Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching, preaching, healing. Then his fame went throughout all Syria. Great multitudes followed him from Galilee, from Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond Jordan. Jesus wasn't a person who was working in small circles. Jesus was an individual who was notorious in his day, and hence such a historic and well-believed and received figure even in the world today, with some 2.3 billion people believing that he truly was an individual of history and according to claim. So, what else did we find? Well, it's good to find things in the Scriptures, and we'll talk about more of the Scriptures here in just a moment, but it's also important that we have external evidences that support the Scriptures as well. And when we look back to various historical figures in the first and second centuries, we find plentiful support that Jesus was a reality and that he ultimately lived up to the claims of which he had promoted, and that the things of the Bible are accurate. When you look at this particular list of individuals, from Josephus to Justin Martyr to Clement of Alexandria, who we'll read from here in a moment, Irenaeus, Origen, all these individuals, historical individuals who ultimately were writing accounts of history. And in their accounts of history, they did as any historian would do. They went out and they researched the things of which they were going to write about. Sometimes the research included other texts. Sometimes the research included, in many cases, interviews with individuals. And in some of these cases, based on the dates of which these individuals lived, not only would they have lived in the near future from Jesus' death, with people still living who were eyewitness accounts of those things and eyewitness accounts of hearing his messages taught, they could have interviewed and asked questions and verified the information. Even as Jesus had said, "Ask and you'll find answers of those who have heard me." And so, these historians certainly would have done their due diligence to research to determine whether or not the things were factual before they were recorded them for the annals of time. And these obviously record various things about Jesus and give testimony that Jesus was real and that he was acclaimed to be the Son of God. Let's look at a couple of examples of that, for instance. Notice here, first of all, I'd like to look at Publius Cornelius Tacitus, who lived between 54 and 117 A.D., and he was a Roman historian and senator. Now, if you'll think about it for just a moment, it does historians no favor to their people if they record histories that are antagonistic of their people. And the Romans were the ones that put Jesus to death. The Romans certainly would bear responsibility of also persecuting the early Christians. And we'll look at some of that here in just a moment. But anyway, this individual was a person of great renown. He was not only a historian, but he was also a statesman, being a senator, and would have been one who would reflect public opinion, especially of that day. He says in Annals, in 109 A.D., he says, Nero, speaking of the one who was in charge of Rome at that time, he says, the infamy of being believed to have ordered the inferno, the fire of Rome. Hence, to suppress the rumor, he falsely charged with the guilt and punished with the most exquisite tortures the persons commonly called Christians, who were hated for their enormities. Christus, the Roman name for Christ, the founder of the name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, procreator of Judea in the region of Tiberias. And so, Tacitus ultimately tells us about Christians, speaks of Christ as a reality in history for those who would say Christ isn't real. Obviously, they have to fight a laundry list of historians to be able to overcome that, which they certainly cannot. But even speaks of his founding of Christianity and being put to death in the factual state of Pontius Pilate. Now, he doesn't go on and give a lot of other details that such as we would wish, but other historians do give us some interesting details that would speak to the truthfulness of the biblical account. For instance, Titus Flavius Josephus lived between 37 and 100 AD. He was a Romano-Jewish scholar and historian. Notice he's Jewish and he's Roman. And that, in those cases, again, he represents a group of people, and groups of people, too, in fact, that were antagonistic to Christ and Christianity. The Jews, obviously, being the ones who led Jesus to his death and wanting to put him to death, and then the Romans who carried it out. Josephus says this in 93 AD in Antiquities. He says, now there was about this time a wise man. Now, if you were to stop there, you would say, okay, just an interesting individual in history, a person with great teaching ability. But he goes on and says, if it would be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works. Now, he's not talking about some of us who might go and build a playground at a park or go erect a library. No, he's talking about miraculous works. And we'll see evidence of that as we go on. He says, a teacher of such men has received the truth with pleasure. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, Jews, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day. What did he say? They saw him resurrected from the dead. Resurrected from the dead. As the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. Meaning the fulfillment of prophecy. And the sect of Christians so named from him are not extinct at this day. And so here Josephus writes of Christ, and in fact writes of him in a way that affirms the biblical account of Jesus' not only reality, but resurrection, and even those who followed the Christians, but he was a fulfillment of prophecy. He truly was Messiah, or the promised one, according to prophecy. So, when it comes to the individuals as historians would have interviewed or possibly gotten some account from, wouldn't it be nice if we could actually read some of the eyewitness accounts? It's nice to see that there are historians we can go back and we can read and we can admire their writings to see the things that they ultimately researched and brought forward to us and recorded in the annals of history that we might be able to glean some fact and some support to the evidence of which we believe according to the Bible. But wouldn't it be nice if we actually heard from the eyewitnesses themselves? And so people ask the question, and sometimes I get it, maybe you get it yourself. Is there anything out there written in history that ultimately is an eyewitness who saw Jesus, who speaks of writing about what they saw of him and what they heard of him? Some third party who ultimately gave us some insight to what he might have been like and what he taught? Well, we do. But before I give you their names, let me start by giving you their credibility. Let me start by giving you their background to see the variability of their background, to see the coexistence of all of these individuals, but also the supporting evidence that when it comes, when stories come and collaborate from all sorts of groups and places in the society, that that should lend some support to their story. First of all, there was Roman government officials. Of course, we saw one just a moment ago who was a historian, but he wasn't necessarily an eyewitness. He had to research those things. But there was one who was a Roman government official who spoke of Jesus, and he worked for the state. He was a tax collector, and being a tax collector, he was an educated man. Then there was also a Gentile physician, a non-Jew, who was a doctor. And that particular doctor had a Roman name, and certainly because he was a doctor, had to have a great and extensive education, especially as much as he talked about the physical nature of man. We also find that there was a Jewish zealot, a Pharisee. Pharisees, in many cases, opposed Christian activity in Christ as the Messiah. But there was a Jewish zealot who was of a rabbinical school, so he was a very educated man, whom also was a Roman citizen by birth, and was in fact a persecutor of Christians. And so to hear from him and to hear from the opposition would be very important as well. Then there were also those among Jesus and their society, Jewish fishermen, just average, everyday, blue-collared working class. And then there was also even a pupil of early church fathers who reported of the things that he had learned and possibly things that he himself had observed as a young boy. And then, wouldn't it be nice to hear from the family themselves? Such as half-brothers who at one point may have opposed Jesus' claims, but then would give us the full account later on about all that they learned of him. Well, who are we talking about? We're talking about the writers of the New Testament. When people think about the Bible, especially the New Testament, they quickly think of it as one book, and they don't think about it as being unique writings, historical writings, literary works that are historic and written by individuals who bear some of the names. For instance, those of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And Luke, the physician, also wrote the book of Acts. Paul wrote the Pauline letters that bear his name. And certainly he also wrote various letters to individuals. And then we also have, obviously, John, who wrote the book of Revelation, and also three letters from him. Peter, who wrote his letters. And then you have James and Jude, the half-brothers of Jesus. Now, these individuals represent a lot of cultural diversity, and yet all of them speak uniformly and harmoniously of Jesus. And when you weigh those things side by side, you get a masterful account, yes, that's in one work called the Bible, the New Testament specifically. But those things are ultimately representation of the eyewitnesses who saw Jesus and then put their faith in Jesus. It didn't matter their background. Ultimately, his story had an impact on their lives, and they set forth to write about that. Notice some of the things that were recorded by them. Luke, in Luke chapter 1, the physician says in verse 1, "Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which have been fulfilled amongst us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us. It seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things, from the very first to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed." Notice the powerful language this physician writes, in which he is proclaiming that, yes, the things that are written by many eyewitness authors are true. And I write to you my own account to ultimately support that. Notice also 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, John says, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, therefore," as he goes on to say, "we have seen with our own eyes," they are eyewitnesses, "which we have looked upon and our hands have handled concerning the word of life. The life was manifested, and we have seen and bear witness and declare to you that eternal life, which was with the Father, was manifested to us. That which we have seen and heard, we declare to you, that you also may have fellowship with us. And truly our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ," him who He's been talking about, "and these things we write to you, that your joy may be full." And so John is speaking of Jesus. He is speaking of interactions with Jesus, hearing his teachings, seeing him work his works that Josephus even mentioned. And he says these things they write that his audience may know that they're true and know that the faith that they put in these things is absolute. Well, what's interesting about all of this, and what's important to keep in context too, is that all these individuals who wrote these things, they wrote these things not because they were like the Harry Potter books. They didn't write them because it was going to be like the movie Star Wars. They weren't going to be popular. They are popular today, but they weren't popular in the day at which they were written. They wrote them in a time of which many who would stand up and proclaim Jesus as the Christ, the Son of God, would be persecuted. And in fact, would either be tortured or be put to death for making those claims. And in fact, many of them gave their lives for that. So you have to think about that for a moment. You think about these individuals who were everything from common day, everyday men, working class individuals, all the way up to very educated, with individuals who had very positive outlooks for their futures because of their education and their practices, that they would ultimately give all of that up in their life also for the story that they wish to tell to others and proclaim to the world. And by doing that, they and all who believed in that, those who came together every Lord's Day faithfully, keeping in the doctrines of the apostles and the breaking of bread and the fellowship, Acts chapter 2, verse 42, which they did steadfastly, that alone was enough to put their lives in danger. And because of it, it was a great testimony. It is a great testimony to the world still today that those people had seen things, heard things, and were willful to believe those things to the point of giving their life for them. For giving their life for them. And we need to think about that. What would you today be willing to believe to the point you'd give your life for it? Let that just marinate a moment. What today would you be willing to give your life for? These individuals would not have given their lives in mass for a lie, especially things they had seen with their own eyes or which they knew others who were close to them had witnessed. And honestly, it wouldn't have just been by word of mouth from somebody else. There had to be plentiful evidence for them to put their lives at jeopardy for these things. So those of the persecuted Christians of the first century, they are a fantastic testimony as why Jesus Christ's claim of divinity is true. Notice what it is said in the Scriptures, Acts chapter 8 and verse 1. Now Saul was consenting, ultimately later this becomes the Apostle Paul who becomes a believer, but at one point he wasn't. He said he was consenting to Stephen's death, the first Christian martyr in the Bible. At that time, a great persecution arose against the church. Acts 22 and verse 4, I saw persecuted this way, Christianity, to death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women. In Acts chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, now about that time, Herod the king stretched out his hand to harass some from the church. Then he killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. And because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to seize Peter also. Acts 14 and verse 19, then Jews from Antioch and Iconium came there, and having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. Yes, many of these individuals paid the ultimate price for their belief in Jesus Christ. Today, what do we get if we say we believe in Jesus Christ? Now, the last two nights, if it's the right audience, with those who are obviously proponents of evolution or proclaimed atheists, we might get a little ridicule. But you know what? I work with those individuals every day. You might do the same as well. I've never been threatened with a stone or a sword. I've never even lost my job over it. And I certainly don't threaten when I go home at night. I don't feel threatened here in this assembly. And I'm sure none of you feel threatened at all either. Yeah, we'll get a little harassment. But the harassment that was stated here is not a harassment in that it is verbal. It's a harassment in that they were thrown into jail. That they were ultimately beaten or in some way taken to the point of death but not crossed over. But yes, some did. Some did die by the sword, and some certainly died by stoning. These individuals' testimony is extremely important, and we need to emphasize it to those who would sit there and waver and wonder, was Jesus really claimed to be? And ask them the question, is with so many people given their lives so freely, if it wasn't true? And they had the ability to validate that story in their day and in their time. So why did people believe? Well, let's summarize a couple of these things in our closing minutes here this morning. Why did people believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God? Was it just because he made the claim that he was the Son of God and he affirmed those claims and that the others made those claims and that there were certain stories written about him? No, there was a lot more to that. Number one, Jesus was one of a kind. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14 says, seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. We noted that earlier. Notice verse 15. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. There is no other person in all the world who can make this claim. No other person in all the world who could have lived out their life and been tempted by Satan himself, mind you, and still have never sinned. And guess what? He was a public figure. How many public figures do we hear today debating for the opportunity to become leader of the United States? And we know everything about them. Public figures don't get out there in the public light and not find the dirt on them. But yet Jesus, being a public figure, no dirt was ever dug up on him. Never was there a point in which he was accused of sin and that be held to be true. What's interesting about that is that when we look to the Bible, that nearly every great and notable individual in the Bible had some sort of flaw or failure exposed within the Scriptures. It doesn't matter how popular they were, whether it be Adam and Eve in the beginning, whether it was Noah, Abraham, and Sarah, whether it was their children and grandchildren, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, or Aaron, whether it was Saul, David, or Solomon, or Peter, or Paul. It doesn't matter. All throughout the Bible is the story of how these were men and women and being of mankind, and being subject to our carnal bodies, they failed at times. They sinned. And there's no apology in the Bible for that because of their human nature. The difference was people who kept trying to do what's right and overcome their sin, and there was those who just lived in sin. And that was the difference between those who would try to follow after God and those who simply opposed God. But when it came to Jesus and all that is written of him, never was there sin in his life. He is uniquely different from all others and certainly would have been different in his society as well. He was outstandingly unique in the way he taught. In Mark chapter 1, verse 22, and they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as having authority. Notice also in Luke chapter 2, verse 47, and all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. Notice the recurring theme, the astonishment of people. Why was that? Here we go. John chapter 7, verse 15, according to the New American Standard, the Jews then were astonished, saying, how has this man become learned, having never been educated? You know, for the last two evenings, excuse me while I get a drink. For the last two evenings, I've been sharing with you about evolution. And I do that uniquely. And then I have a special education in both the life sciences and also geology. And what if I was to stand up here after two nights of lecturing and telling you about all the things that I have come to understand about all of those sciences and said, you know, I've never went to school. I never had a formal education. Or I even tell you I couldn't read or write. You would be astonished, wouldn't you? Well, there's a reason these people were astonished at Jesus' ability to teach and all the knowledge that he had. Because they knew he had never been educated. He had never been educated. And even as a young boy, when he was at the temple, those who had been educated were astonished at him at a ripe age of 14 when they couldn't understand how he came to know so much. Jesus was unique in that. He was truly the Word, manifest Word amongst us. He was inspired of God. In Matthew chapter 13, verse 54 through 56, when Jesus had come to his own country, now these are people who knew Jesus from his upbringing, he taught them in their synagogue. And so they were, yet here's our word again, astonished, and said, where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? Is this not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And his brothers, James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas. And his sisters, are they not all with us? Where then did this man get all these things? Even the people Jesus grew up around were astonished at him because they knew what opportunities had been afforded him. They certainly knew how he would have gained knowledge if it had ever occurred, but they had no account of how that could have ever been possible. And so, they again were astonished because of his outstanding uniqueness. But Jesus also had miraculous ability. Not only was he inspired miraculously, he was also able to work miraculous things. Acts 2, verse 22. Excuse me. Here Peter says, "Men of Israel, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested by God," and that word attested by God literally means the idea of witnessed to you, "attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves also know." And so part of the testimony of Jesus Christ is that he had a sign of heavenly ability. Therefore, one who is representing heavenly power, God himself, through these works. In John chapter 3, it says, There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, "Rabbi," meaning teacher, "we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him." So Nicodemus, a member of the opposing party to Jesus, even recognized that Jesus was unique in his miraculous ability, and he understood what the purpose of that miraculous ability was to speak in the essence that it was a testimony that he was sent from God. And certainly that was the case. In all the miracles that Jesus did many things to overcome many physical and natural elements. He cured people of various illnesses and disease. He certainly had power over physical elements such as water, being able to turn it to wine. He was able to calm the storms of the sea. He was able to feed people with just a handful of food. And the list goes on and on. And in fact, there's some 40 recorded miracles of which Jesus did, including raising the dead. Raising the dead. He was able to have power over everything. He wasn't a one-trick pony, as we might say. He was one who had power over everything, and there were no limitations to him. And of course, we're not surprised by that, by those who believe in Jesus Christ, because John 1 bears out he's co-creator of everything. And if he has created everything, he has power over everything. But the amazing part is, and going back to the idea of a testimony, is the testimony of what one unique writer out of all of this group has to say about it. Luke, Dr. Luke, the physician, ultimately dials in on all of these medical wonders, doesn't he? Dr. Luke is amazed because Dr. Luke can't do these things. And Dr. Luke doesn't know of anyone in the practice who can do these things. And so when Luke writes about them, he's excited to share it with you. He's excited to record it in history because he knows the uniqueness of this skill. And he knows how impossible it is for anyone to have such power over all of these things. And so when you read Luke and you read about the things that Luke liked to write about, it's an amazing testimony that needs to be shared with others. So when it comes to the miraculous works of Jesus, they certainly speak to his existence and as well as his identity. In John chapter 20, verse 30, "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." The whole purpose of his miracles, as John points out, is to testify that he is the Son of God, and that you will put your belief in him. John chapter 7, verse 31. Here's the response of those of the first century, those who would face persecution because of this testimony. In John 7, 31, "And many of the people believed in him and said, 'When the Christ comes, will he do more signs than these which this man has done?'" That's a rhetorical question. The answer is no. There is going to be no better signage than Jesus Christ and what he ultimately shared with all the world, which is written by eyewitnesses in the New Testament scriptures. In Matthew chapter 11, verses 2 through 5, there it says, "And when John had heard in prison about the works of Christ," now this is John the Baptist, John the Baptist is in prison because he was the precursor, the pre-runner, forerunner of Jesus Christ. And in promoting truth and promoting Christ, he ultimately is put in prison. And in this case, he has heard about the works, not just his ministry, but about the miraculous works of Christ as well. He sent two of his disciples and said to him, "Are you the coming one, or Messiah, or do we look for another?" Now, Jesus could have answered these individuals in a very clear and simple way. He could have just answered with an affirmative yes. Yes, I am. He had certainly answered various individuals who had him on trial with that type of answer and saying, "I am." But you know, it obviously wasn't to their benefit. They weren't going to believe him no matter what he said. But when it comes to John, Jesus gives a unique answer in a unique situation that really is an amazing testimony of Jesus Christ. He ultimately says, "Go and tell John the things which you hear and see. The blind see, and the lame walk, and the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them." Now, why would he tell these things to John instead of clarifying that he was the Christ, the Son of God? Because John was raised by his father, Zechariah, a rabbinical priest who had taught him the Old Testament scriptures. And what he had taught him about the Old Testament scriptures was the prophecy of those scriptures. And in the prophecies of those scriptures, in Isaiah 35, verses 5 through 6, and speaking of the Messiah as how we would identify him when he arrived, it said, "Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb sing." Jesus didn't have to say, "I am the Christ." He didn't have to say, "I am the Son of God." He said, "You go take the knowledge that you have of me, you report it to John, and John will know that I am the Christ, the Son of God." So not only did the miracles testify of Jesus' sonship, but also his fulfillment of prophecies. Notice in Matthew chapter 27, verse 35, "Then they crucified him and divided his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, 'They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots.'" Fulfillment of Psalm 22, verse 18. The writers of the New Testament, being eyewitnesses and also having knowledge of the Old Testament scriptures, were sure to point out that when Jesus fulfilled prophecy, they were doing it for a reason. They were giving the testimony of Jesus Christ that he was the Messiah. We also note, for example, in Mark chapter 15, verse 27 and 28, in reference to Isaiah 53 and 12, "With him they also crucified two robbers, one on his right and the other on his left. So the scripture was fulfilled, which says, 'And he was numbered with the transgressors.'" When we look to the Old Testament, of all the prophecies that were going to be pertaining to the Messiah, we find that Jesus Christ not only fulfills some, he fulfills all of them. He fulfills numerous things about where he would be born, what his life would be like, where he would live, who his heritage was going to be from, ultimately what he was going to be like in many ways in his ministry, how he was going to arrive even into Jerusalem, how he would be identified, that he would indeed be declared the Son of God, Psalm chapter 2 and verse 7. But when we look on to all of the others, we would also find about the amazing detail about Jesus' final days in which he would be betrayed, how he would ultimately be slain, and that how he would even after his death be brought back from the dead in his own resurrection. And in all of these things, he fulfilled every single one of them. And when you look through all the Old Testament scriptures, there's some 350 fulfilled prophecies in the scripture. And you start to think to yourself, what are the odds of an individual fulfilling 350 unique prophecies? Not just vague and ambiguous, unique and specific prophecies pertaining to him, including the way he would die. Let me give you a quick example so that you can entertain your mind as what those possibilities are without going into probability and statistics. I'm going to give you a couple descriptions, and in your mind, I believe you can come to an answer. You younger ones might struggle with this, but those that are older, you might get it. An individual will play basketball. He will go to college at North Carolina. He would turn professional. He would play for the Chicago Bulls, and he'd wear number 23. Now, I don't have to tell you about the contracts with Nike, how much he would make, and how popular he'd be in our society. But from those five elements, many of you already got Michael Jordan. How many unique prophecies do you need to single out an individual in the world? Not many. Not many. Now, in some cases, maybe we have a little more ambiguous lifestyles, but it won't take 350 to single out an individual. But 350 are more than enough to recognize when it is the one and only one in all the world of which the prophecies are speaking of. And Jesus fulfilled every single one of those. And certainly the early disciples knew that. Jesus himself not only met prophecy, but he himself prophesied, opening himself up to examination and testability by others. Because if he prophesied of something and it didn't come to be true, then certainly he wasn't the Messiah after all. And so Jesus gives us another litmus test. For instance, he speaks of the destruction of Jerusalem in Luke chapter 21 and verses 5 through 6. Then as some of his disciples spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, he said, "These things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone will be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Luke 24, verse 15. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation," notice he's going to give even an interpretation of Old Testament prophecy, "spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Did the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple occur? Yes, it did. 70 AD. Accounted by historians. How about the persecution of the saints? We know about the first and second and third century persecutions of Christians, but Jesus foretold that that was going to happen in Luke 21, verse 12. "But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons." And of course, those are fulfilled in Acts 8 and 9. "You will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake," Acts 9. Also, all of chapters 21 through 28. But it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Do you know the persecution of the first century Christians is a testimony for us today to witness to people about Christ as the Son of God and the Messiah? He said, "It will happen to you as an occasion for testimony. You will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends. They will put some of you to death, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake." Ultimately, he also prophesied of the establishment and the permanency of the church in Matthew 16, verses 15 through 18. He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" This is Jesus speaking to his disciples. Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." There is that answer once again, the confession, the great and noble confession. Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock, on this foundation, the principle that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, not Peter, not little pebble, as some people try to propose. No, little pebbles aren't going to hold it up. The big rock, the foundation, the substrate of the earth, that's going to stay permanent. He says, upon this solid foundation, this rock, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. For all of those who would even begin to remotely propose that Jesus built a church on a human being, those who had proposed that Jesus left the church behind as a replacement because he wasn't able to establish his kingdom such as he was supposed to do, they teach blasphemy. They teach blasphemy that attacks the deity of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And they need to take a step back and they need to re-examine their position on those things. If he is the Son of God, if he is divinity, man will not ever overthrow him. As was stated, 10,000 angels could have came down from heaven and utterly destroyed humanity. if it would have been a part of his plan. He could have done it, but no, the church was his plan. That's why it was allowed to come in existence, and he paid the price for those things in fulfillment of the scriptures according to prophecy. And yes, his death, his burial, and his resurrection are according to prophecy. I leave this with you this morning. When it comes to the death, burial, and resurrection, these are some of the strongest things that ultimately speak of Jesus as the Son of God. In Matthew 17, verse 22 and 23, the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and the third day he will be raised up. Jesus never tried to keep it a secret from the disciples. Three times he told them very specifically what was going to happen when they arrived in Jerusalem. He told them that his days were numbered. He told them that he would be killed. But he also said, in 3 days, I'll be raised up, speaking of his own resurrection. Mark chapter 10, verse 33 and 34. Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him. And the third day he'll rise again. All of this in fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 53. Which shares it in such great and vivid detail as to have been there, but yet hundreds of years before this day. In Matthew chapter 12, verse 40, alluding to Jonah 1 and 17, "For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth." John 2, verse 19, Jesus answered and said to them, "Destroy this temple in 3 days, I will raise it up." But he was speaking of the temple of his body. Therefore, when he had been risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this to them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. All these according to prophecy also. The idea here is that the resurrection from the dead is fulfillment of prophecy. And Acts 3 verse 18 says, "But those things which God foretold by the mouth of all of his prophets, that the Christ would suffer, he has thus fulfilled." Going back to those who had proposed that Jesus died not according to God's plan, do not understand the Old Testament scriptures, that they spoke clearly that Jesus would die and had to die to become the perfect sacrifice for sin, that we might all have hope of eternity. And that's why I say that kind of teaching that teaches against this is blasphemy. And they do not know and have ignorance of the scriptures, because it is clear from the scriptures. And the early disciples knew that this was fulfillment of prophecy, that all these things had to take place. So the resurrection is ultimately one of the strongest points. And obviously, when we look at, for instance, I won't read all of this one, but 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 8, when we read how individuals saw Jesus after his death, after his resurrection, and even then saw him ascend to heaven, those are eyewitness accounts of individuals who recorded for the annals of time that these things are true, and that these things testify as Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. And reasons why every one of these would risk their own life to tell the story. And no matter what, no matter how much they were tortured to the point of death, that when individuals who wished to rebuke them for their faith, rebuke them for what they taught about Jesus, rebuke them for making accusations against the Jews and the Romans for putting him to death, that these individuals would not be turned from their confession of faith and would hold true to that faith right to the point of their last breath. And that stands as a testimony to us today and one we need to share with others. Romans chapter 1, verse 3 and 4. I leave this passage with you this morning because it is so powerful. Paul says, and remember, Paul, the persecutor of Christians who turned because of what he saw and what he came to believe in, and even his own personal encounter with Jesus Christ. He says, "Concerning his Son, Jesus Christ our Lord, who was born of the seed of David according to the flesh, and declared to be the Son of God with power, according to the Spirit of holiness, by the resurrection from the dead." Ultimately, it's the resurrection from the dead that culminates the story of Jesus Christ. As I was talking with, I believe it was David in the back the other night, we were talking about for just a moment there how of all the evidences people wish. You know, we wish for evidence too sometimes. And what we wish of those who would attack the story of Jesus Christ is, show me the grave. Show me where the body is laid. And then we'll start to give some credence to your attacks. And the point is that there is no grave today. There is no body found. And even in all the feeble attempts to try to cover up an amazing story of how disciples could have stole that body away from Roman centurions in a guarded and sealed location, that location ultimately is empty today. And all the eyewitnesses that saw Jesus afterward, and those who would put their hands and fingers inside the nail-pierced hands and the nail-pierced feet and that pierced side, and who then saw him ascend back to heaven, they have left us a testimony that affirms that Jesus Christ is who he was and who he claimed to be. And you can put your faith in that, and you can share that faith freely and openly with the rest of the world, and you can have an amazing impact on those people's lives, helping them to understand and believe those things as well, and to submit themselves to not just Jesus, the Son of God, but Lord and King Jesus, who rules in our lives and is the Savior of mankind. This morning, we've looked at a number of things, but I want to leave this one last idea with you. I left the passage with you, but I want to leave this last quote by Flavius Josephus in 93 AD. We don't know if Flavius, I don't think, I mean, maybe Clint can help me out. I don't know if he ever became a Christian. I don't think he did. But it's amazing what he wrote, and I can't believe that he ever did. He said, he was the Christ. And when Pilate condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold. You know, that testimony alone, no matter who it came from, should have spoke wonders to all the audiences who read it, and certainly should stand as a testimony of Jesus Christ today.